Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Alan Saunders, and this is the first new Philosopher's Zone of 2008. And we're beginning the new year with an old voice.
I think you can romanticise students' reasons for not doing science. Largely, it's very hard work. Very much harder work than any art subject except a difficult language. You really have got to spend most of your student life thinking about what you're doing. Well, people don't like that. Much easier to do English or sociology or something where there's no hard content. But I'm afraid I am really very hard-boiled about this. I don't believe in these ingenious theories for people's metaphysical doubts and so on. People are governed much more by mundane concerns.
The rather pontifical tones of C.P. Snow, the English physicist and novelist who died in 1980. One of the things for which he's best remembered, if he's remembered at all these days, is a public lecture he delivered in 1959 called The Two Cultures, in which he argued that the two cultures of modern society, the sciences and the humanities, were incapable of communicating with each other. A good many times, he said, I have been present at gatherings of people who, by the standards of the traditional culture, are thought highly educated, and who have with considerable gusto been expressing their incredulity at the illiteracy of scientists. Once or twice I have been provoked, and have asked the company how many of them could describe the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy. The response was cold. It was also negative. Yet I was asking something which is about the scientific equivalent of, have you read a work of Shakespeare's? Fortunately, not everybody was so ignorant.
The second law of thermodynamics. Heat cannot of itself pass from one body to a hotter body.
Heat cannot of itself pass from one body to a hotter body.
Heat won't pass from a cooler to a hotter.
Heat won't pass from a cooler to a hotter.
You can try it if you like, but you'd far better not.
You can try it if you like, but you'd far better not.
Cos the cold in the cooler will get hotter as a ruler.
Cos the cold in the cooler will get hotter as a ruler.
Because the hotter body's heat will pass to the cooler.
Cos the hotter body's heat will pass to
as
the cooler.
Heat is work, and work is heat, and work is heat, and heat is work. Heat will pass by conduction and
heat. Heat will pass by conduction and
heat. Heat will pass by convection.
Heat will pass by convection.
Heat will pass by radiation.
Heat will pass by radiation.
And that's a physical law. Heat is work and work's a curse. And all the heat in the universe is gonna cool down. Because it can't increase. Then there'll be no more work and there'll be perfect peace.
Really?
Yeah, that's entropy, man.
The mildly satirical Flanders and Swan demonstrating their grasp of thermodynamics. But perhaps Snow had missed the point. Perhaps what matters is not that there are two cultures, but that one of them, science, has become the dominant mode of explanation in the world. This, broadly speaking, is the subject of a new book, the first of a projected 5 volumes, by Stephen Gaukroger, Professor of the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney. It's called The Emergence of a Scientific Culture, Science and the Shaping of Modernity, 1210 to 1685. Note those dates. There's an account of the history of science that students, me included, used to be given, and it ran a bit like this. There was this thing called the Scientific Revolution, and it began in 1543 with the publication of Copernicus's book De Revolutionibus, which argued that the Earth revolves around the Sun rather than the Sun the Earth. And it ended in 1687 with the publication of Isaac Newton's Principia. There were a few stragglers in this story, principally the chemists who didn't really get their act together until the 18th century, but that's basically the Scientific Revolution for you, 1543 to 1687. Now Gaukroger has given us a book that begins in 1210 and ends in 1685, which implies a very different story. So what's going on here?
Well, I accept in some sense the outlines of a 17th century scientific revolution, though I don't really think it starts with Copernicus. It starts with the uptake of Copernicus at the end of the 16th century. But I think there are very important events that begin at the beginning of the 13th century that shape Western culture in a very distinctive way, so that when the scientific revolution does occur at the end of the 16th, early 17th century, it occurs in a context that's been, in some ways unintentionally, but prepared in a certain way. And the main form of preparation is that science, or natural philosophy as it was called then, has an important cultural role, which prior to the 13th century it didn't have.
If we're talking about the cultural change here, we're talking, aren't we, about science eventually becoming the one and only recognised source of knowledge?
We are indeed, though of course that's contested, but there is a view, a strong view, that science is the kind of standard for anything that's going to make cognitive claims. So they've either got to be made in scientific terms, or they've got to be made in accord with standards of evidence and reasoning and things that science itself is deemed to have set and itself met.
So we now have a situation where Paul Davies, for example, the physicist, can say, yes, there's a God, and science shows us that there's a God. Yes. That's how we know there's a God.
Yes. That of course, is a very problematic kind of claim for all kinds of reasons. But it does illustrate one thesis that a lot of people have drawn attention to, which is that science takes, since the 17th century at least, science has taken over certain kinds of claim from religion. It's taken over certain claims to universality, to comprehensiveness from religion. And of course, what both traditional advocates of religious thought and these new, more reductionist advocates of the universality of scientific thought assume is that there is some one single discourse that's going to tell us ultimately about everything. Maybe not in the short term, maybe not in the middle term, but ultimately there's one level of understanding of the universe, and it was either provided by science or by religion, but the crucial thing is there's only one. And certainly that's one thing that I would want to challenge and have challenged in this book.
Well, it's interesting that you actually begin your book by mentioning Edward Gibbon, the author of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and he's talking about the decline in belles lettres, that is to say, polite literature.
Yes.
He doesn't want religion to continue its dominance, but he's not a scientist, he doesn't want science to continue his dominance. So there's another way, which is the way of the humanities, which is the way of understanding ourselves as human beings and social beings. So that also, as well as religion, has been subsumed or replaced by science, hasn't it?
Oh, certainly. That and other things. I think there are a number of different things going on here. And Gibbon's interesting because if one sees a decline in the standing of religion in the 17th and 18th centuries, and 19th century particularly, it's not science that leads that decline at all, quite the contrary. Well, it varies very much from context to context, but in the context of Britain, science and certain forms of religion, particularly a form of High Anglicanism and also a form later on of Methodism, are very closely connected and mutually supportive in an English context. Not in France, but in England there's a very close connection. If you want the kind of radical cutting edge that undermines religion's claims to absolute authority, it's history that provides the ammunition, both in the 17th century and particularly in someone like Gibbon, who's of crucial importance in using history as a way of assessing the legitimacy of various kinds of cognitive claim in science, and but particularly in religion, and establishing history as an independent way of assessing the value of particular kinds of discourse. And there's something very peculiar and unique that happens in early modern culture in the West. And the peculiarity of this culture is that science emerges as the bearer of rational values. And looking at that historically, we can open up all kinds of questions about how and why and with what legitimacy this occurs that we can't engage if we just treat it as a philosophical exercise.
I want to come on shortly to the apparent uniqueness of this process, its apparent peculiarity to the West. But another aspect of the role of science now and the way in which that role is supported is that science is said to enjoy a sort of moral superiority to other ways of approaching the world. It's seen very often as more open, more democratic. The 20th century philosopher Karl Popper sort of embodies this approach to science.
That's true. That's particularly so in the first half of the 20th century, when you have a number of programs for trying to reground morality on a scientific as opposed to a theological basis. So many of these attempts were seen as a practical way of replacing religion with science. And what they went for was the question of morality. This is an issue on which religion had traditionally made great claims, most notably that you can't have a morality without religion. These claims had really been undermined at the end of the 17th century in Bale and others who'd pointed out the case of China, the moral atheist. And there were lots of disputes over whether you did or didn't need religion for morality. But the issues were certainly opened up early on. But what happened in the early 20th century is that some people thought that religion has made these traditional claims. It's wrong in making them. But perhaps there's still something about the claims that's right. It's just that people have misidentified what it is that provides the foundation for morality. There must be a foundation. It's not in religion. Where, therefore, is it? Well, not in the humanistic disciplines or other areas where one might reasonably expect to find it, but rather in science. So then the question arises, well, how could science possibly provide a foundation for morality? Well, there are certain ways of construing morality that derive from Kant and others, whereby it's very closely associated with rationality.
This is Immanuel Kant, the 18th century Immanuel German Kant. Philosopher. Yes.
Exactly. And so there's a close connection from there onwards between a connection that everyone accepts, but many moral philosophers accept, this close connection between canons of rationality and canons of moral behaviour. In the early 20th century, logical positivists, evolutionists and others argued that, well, it's science that supplies canons of rationality. So if it provides canons of rationality generally, maybe it provides them for morality as well, given there's this connection. And there's a move to develop a scientific basis for morality. That peters out a little bit with the decline of logical positivism around mid-century after the Second World War, but you can still find it in the 50s. Since then, it hasn't been as much in evidence. So there's the odd person who might defend it in evolutionary terms, for example.
But in the case particularly of Popper, his most famous book, which is not a book of personal morality, but of political philosophy, The Open Society and Its Enemies. If you look at the open society, a society that is open to questioning, inquiry, the putting forward of hypotheses, presumably in this case hypotheses for the way in which policies are going to operate, and the challenging of those hypotheses, his open society for the entire community is just an enlarged version of the way he sees the open society of, let's say, the laboratory.
That's quite right. And Popper's view of the scientist is that the scientist has a distinctive and unique form of intellectual morality, because the scientist is not committed to showing that he or she is right, but rather committed to showing that they are wrong, that the theories that they put so much effort into, what they're committed to doing is to falsifying those. And this is the high point of intellectual morality for Popper. Now, of course, intellectual morality and what we normally think of as morality are not the same thing, but they're really rather closely connected. There's a notion of intellectual honesty and the idea that you try and falsify your hypotheses rather or conjectures rather than show that they're true is interpreted by Popper in terms of intellectual honesty. Now, I think Popper's onto something there. I think to try and do it in methodological terms actually gets you nowhere, and it gets you nowhere very, very quickly. So I think Popper's project, or the way in which Popper tries to realise the project in methodological terms, that morality is to do with commitment to a particular kind of method, that's to say intellectual morality is to do with commitment to a particular kind of method, gets you nowhere. On the other hand, there is a genuine, difficult issue about the intellectual morality of the scientist, because really from the 17th century onwards, it's been crucial to the standing of the scientist and scientific work that there's an intellectual honesty in the scientist that you don't find, for example, in scholastic natural philosophers.
That's the sort of medieval tradition.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly. And they're often criticised by the new scientists of the 17th century in highly moral terms. So morality does come in at really quite a fundamental level. It's just that it turns out to be a very, very difficult question. I mean, I've tried to explore it in the book in a number of dimensions, but it became clear to me at a very early stage that simply doing it through notions of method didn't get you anywhere.
On Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Professor Stephen Gaukroger about the emergence of science. Now, it's important to realise, isn't it, that in the days of its emergence, science itself wasn't seen as a neutral, value-free field of inquiry.
No, not at all. It was seen as embodying certain kinds of values that one pitted against other values or groups who one thought lacked those values. The idea of science as a value-free form of inquiry is a complex question. Again, it's very much an early 20th century notion. And interestingly, it goes with the idea of science as a basis for morality, though in a rather paradoxical way. The reasoning is that science has the standing it does precisely because it's value-free. It doesn't work on any prejudices or preconceived ideas or anything like that. It works in terms of pure rationality. So in that sense, on a positivist view, it's value-free. Then one might say, well, how can something that's value-free act as a foundation for moral values? How can something that's pure rationality act as a basis for a moral philosophy? And the short answer is it can't. The longer answer is, well, it can only if you impoverish morality to such an extent that it's hardly recognisable. And that, I think, is what happened among some of the positivists.
One value that you might attribute to science, of course, is that it's useful, that it makes us healthier, it makes us live longer, it gives us machines, it gives us better plumbing, which, you know, who wouldn't want better plumbing? And this was what some propagandists for science, like in the 17th century, the English philosopher Francis Bacon, those were the grounds on which they were defending science.
Those claims have always been made for science. The things that we associate with science, like plumbing, like sewerage, like machines, are really from the third decade of the 19th century onwards. Modern science produces very, very few benefits between the scientific revolution and the early 19th century. Even something like anaesthetics, which were known of much, much earlier than they were employed. It took 100 years for people to realise, to actually put them to practical use. Machines, similarly. Machines, of course, have been around since classical antiquity. There was nothing new about certain kinds of machines. The interesting thing about machines in the 17th and 18th century, and early 19th century, or mid-19th century, actually, is that they work so slowly that scientists use statics, that's to say levers, the science of levers, cogs, to understand their working. It was only, I believe, in the 1870s, 1880s that machines speeded up so much that you actually had to start using the theories that had been developed from the 17th century onwards to understand how they worked. So the claims for the usefulness of science from Bacon onwards were really pretty empty. There were certainly developments in clockmaking. There were developments in shipbuilding, but the developments in shipbuilding, which I've looked at a bit, were in the main non-theoretical developments. They were all to do with expertise in towing different shaped bodies through water. They were the practical kinds of things that you don't need a scientific revolution for.
Well, let's ask what's special about the scientific revolution of the West. We all know that there was what could reasonably be called science in ancient China, in ancient Greece, certainly if we're talking about astronomy, amongst the Mayans in pre-Columbian America. And these days we're always being reminded of the achievements of the medieval Islamic world. So what's particular about what happened in the West? Why is it different? Why did we have a scientific revolution? And why does what they had not amount to a scientific revolution?
The answer to this question depends to some extent what you're looking for. If you consider a scientific revolution to be a period of prolonged scientific activity, say over five or six generations, which deals in a novel way with certain basic problems, then you do have scientific revolutions in those cultures. What's distinctive about them, from my point of view, is that they deal with certain fundamental problems, solve them more or less, and then science effectively drops out of the culture or goes onto a back burner or something like that. Science is not a permanent feature of any of those cultures. Science does seem to be, so far as we can tell, a permanent feature of our own culture, certainly since the 16th century, and in some respects even since the 13th century, but certainly since the 16th century. So the question is, why is science a permanent feature of our culture, but not a permanent feature of those other cultures? Well, the answer can't be, I think, that science proved to be useful in our culture, because actually, before the middle of the 19th century, our own science was much less useful than science in China or medieval Islam. Is it that science was particularly successful? Well, no, not compared to classical Greece and the Hellenistic Greek diaspora, China. I think what's distinctive about science in the West is that it's built up a cumulative program, at least from the early 17th century. And this has its ups and downs. Science is severely criticized at times, certainly in 17th century England. It's not taken seriously by many influential people. But it's able to build up a cumulative program over centuries. And the question is, how is it able to do this? And I think that one way in which it's able to do this, a crucial way for the kind of project that I'm interested in, is that it manages to establish itself as a source of guidance on cognitive questions. It manages to establish itself as the canon of rationality. And that last, I think, particularly occurs in mid-18th century France. There are, for example, in 17th and 18th century thought, many criticisms of Christianity on grounds of rationality. But no one before, certainly before the 1730s in France, before Voltaire, thinks that the canons of rationality that one applies to religion come from science. They just think that these are general canons of rationality. What happens in the 1730s and is established in the 1750s in the Encyclopédie in France is the idea that science is ultimately the sole bearer of these canons of rationality. And this, I think, is crucial for the kind of science or the kind of value that science has had in our culture since then. It's got nothing to do with the success of science, except that had science not been successful, then obviously it couldn't have taken on this role. So being successful is a necessary condition, but it certainly is not a sufficient condition. It doesn't establish science as this permanent feature of our culture. The thing that establishes science as a permanent feature of our culture, I believe, is its ability to take over this idea that it embodies canons of rationality. Now, this is much disputed, it's much contested, but it's a struggle that it effectively won, at least up to the middle of the 20th century. After that, the issues become much more open, but at least up to the middle of the 20th century, there was a very dominant idea that science encapsulates the basic canons of rationality.
Stephen Gaukroger, whose book The Emergence of a Scientific Culture, Science and the Shaping of Modernity, 1210 to 1685, is published by Oxford University Press. Details on our website. The Philosopher's Zone is produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production by John Diamond. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with more on the emergence of science, and in particular the question of why it appears to have emerged in the Western world and nowhere else.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.